Hi, Jack Davies. Welcome to KABU.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Jack Davies is fighting the drug wars, trying to stop them and radically change drug policy. He has much experience in that, having worked to fight for medical marijuana and use of other psychedelics. Then he worked for the American Civil Liberties Union on drug law reform. Now he's with the Drug Policy Alliance, which is one of the few left reform organizations with the funds to work in the federal government and in many of the states, and with funding to support anti-drug war projects. So Jack Davies, public attitudes towards addictive drugs and drug policy, too, and the best ways to deal with the many damages of drugs and drug wars, they're rapidly shifting and changing. Now it's poor whites, urban, suburban, rural, that are increasingly obtaining and using and dying from prescription drugs, and that especially in Trump states. Trump has apparently now declared a drug emergency, and they're going to do something at the federal level, I'm afraid, of what? Maybe to intensify the current system, maybe to declare martial law or waive or reduce the scope of the Fourth Search and Seizure Amendment. Anything is possible for them. Jag, let's start at the beginning. Tell us about the current scene. Why a declaration of emergency? What might we expect from them? And then we can get into the really main body of this interview, which is all the wonderful solutions that the Drug Policy Alliance is fighting for.
Yeah, this is a really pivotal moment for drug policy and criminal justice reform. You know, on the one hand, we have a federal administration now that is really determined to ramp up the drug war, which never really ended in a lot of ways. I mean, it sort of plateaued after three decades of skyrocketing in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. Some of news headlines and stuff like that said Obama ended the drug war or things like that. And you know, it really just kind of plateaued. It never went away. And we've made a lot of progress, though, at the state level and at the local level. I mean, with drug policy reform and criminal justice reform and public health reform, you know, the state and local levels is always the first place to make changes and make reforms. I mean, the federal government, no matter who's in office, is always going to be the last one to adopt cutting-edge policies. So even with Trump and Sessions in office, a lot of states like Oregon, but and even states in the South and places you wouldn't expect are moving forward with drug policy reforms, essentially move drug policy out of the criminal justice system and into more of a health-based approach as much as possible. For example, in Oregon just this year, the criminal penalty for drug possession and some other low-level crimes was reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor. But there's still about 30 states around the country that still treat drug possession as a felony, not just as a misdemeanor. And, you know, this is a huge driver of not just mass incarceration, but also mass criminalization. You know, there's 2.2 million people in prison in this country, by far the highest in the world, and about a quarter of them are there simply for a drug law violation. But then you look even at the bigger picture of mass criminalization, there's those 7 or 8 million people who are under some form of criminal justice supervision. And for these things like drug possession, where you have, even in 2016, the last year Obama was in office, there were 1.5 million arrests for drugs, and about 1.3 million of these arrests were just for drug possession. That's a huge number of people, and I think it probably goes without saying for a lot of your audience, but it's worth pointing out, huge discrepancy in the racial disparities, where a lot of white people do get arrested for drugs because the drug war is so huge, but people who are black are 3, 4, 5 times more likely to be brought into the criminal justice system for drugs, even though black and white people, statistically speaking, according to all the data we have, they use and sell drugs at similar rates. It's just the level of police interactions that they have when you take an activity that half the population has done at some point in their life and you criminalize it. You know, it just gives the police an excuse to do a lot of things. And so that's why, even though now we have huge public support for ending the drug war, it's very slow to unwind it because it's so entrenched at so many levels of the system. And of course, police and prosecutors and lots of other vested interests don't want to lose their bread and butter.
Also, it's highly corrupting for all of those people, the enforcers, not to mention what happens to the families and the people who get ensnared in it. They wind up with a record of drug possession and stuff, and they can't get jobs. The families get destroyed. The damage is so enormous, especially to the poor, in fact, I mean, to the lower half, and their capacity just to, in fact, make it an American life, even at a subsistence level. But it's also extremely corrupting for the police because, even at the ground level, they have to violate the Constitution to make their arrests. So they learn how to lie if they ever get on the witness stand. It corrupts police completely. It takes a huge amount of time. It adds to the militarization. They have to match the gunnery of the drug lords, is what they say, right? So they've got, that's part of the reason that they have tanks sitting around in the huge machine guns. And all the rest of this apparatus that they like to use and dress up in and do their thing, they learn how to violate the Constitution, and then they want to change the Constitution to make it easier. It seems to me the drug wars now, they both destroy people, but they're also destroying society and sort of any sense, any possibility of the rule of law.
Yeah, it corrupts public institutions, and you see this happen all over the world as well in a lot of countries that are drug-producing countries where the amount of money being made from drugs is so vast that they end up with more resources than the government. See this happening in dozens of countries around the world. Not only have we done this to ourselves, we've exported this to the rest of the world as well. And yeah, it's hard to even measure the full impact of it because you think of the knock-on effect, the economic effect of when you have tens of millions of people in the country with a criminal record for a low-level drug violation. Once you have a criminal record, you know, it's very hard to get a job. It's very hard. You go to school, like everything you do, you apply for a loan from a bank or you apply, you know, for financial aid, for school or, you know, the kind of things people need to do to like get their lives together. And you're discriminated against. You're punished again over and over again throughout your life. And we're realizing now there's a lot of attention now on bail reform because what people are really realizing now is that about at least half of the people in local jails are generally there just because they're too poor to make bail. So you were basically criminalizing poverty at the same time where wealth is becoming more and more concentrated in the upper echelons. And when you have an activity that, as you said, drug use is a victimless crime. You know, there's no complaining witness. You know, if someone gets robbed or someone is harmed, you have a complaining witness. So you have evidence there. With a drug crime, it's just basically the word of the policeman against someone. So that it's inherently very corrupting. And of course, you also have huge amounts of money involved. A huge part of the drug war, one thing that the EPA has had some success in reforming in some states, is a civil asset forfeiture, where if the government merely suspects you of being involved in a drug crime, they can seize all of your property, your cash, your house, your whatever. And there's actually more law enforcement agencies in the U.S. actually seize more money now from private citizens than the entire amount of all robberies in the country combined. They say that this is about, you know, taking down the big drug kingpins and they need these laws to do that. But actually, almost all the seizures are of very small amounts of just like a few hundred dollars or a few thousand dollars. And again, they're mostly in poor communities of color. So basically what they're doing is they're just shaking down cash from poor people in huge, huge, huge quantities. And a number of states have passed reforms over the past few years. But again, it's one of those things that's very entrenched. It's now built into the police budgets, the assumption that they're going to be seizing a certain amount of money, that it's very hard to kind of unwind it.
One thing we have to say is that it may be more money than all the robberies, but it isn't more money than all the financial frauds, I'll tell you that. Now, there is a pot of money, some of them legal.
Yeah. Yeah, and the really crazy thing about our drug policies is that the whole point of it is that it's supposed to be protecting us from the harms of drugs, where actually it's making drugs much more dangerous, and overdose deaths in this country have skyrocketed over the past few years. A lot of the blame has been put on prescription drugs, but now, over the past few years, many more people are dying of heroin and fentanyl poisonings, and that is a huge public health disaster that is not being sufficiently addressed. And we know the crazy thing about overdoses is that we know how to prevent them. There's countries like Portugal where they decriminalized all drugs and have a really robust health approach to drugs, where there's pretty much no overdoses. An overdose is easily reversible if someone gets medical attention, but it's largely because of the criminalization of drug use that people often don't seek medical help or don't have access to naloxone, the overdose reversal medication. So there's a lot that could be said about what needs to be done. That's a big part of DPA's work, is trying, you know, not just change the criminal justice system, but then also implement public health policies and health policies that actually do address the potential harms of drug use.
Yeah, I just read that about as many lives are lost to drugs, and many of them just prescription drugs, of course, that's another thing we didn't get into, than are lost to guns and car accidents combined. It's unbelievable how many people are dying of drugs. This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Jag Davies, who works with the Drug Policy Alliance and their communications group. The Drug Policy Alliance not just exposes horrible, many harms of the drug wars, but the Drug Policy Alliance also promotes alternatives to the drug wars. Jag, tell us about Portugal. It's really leading the way in the world. It's had great success. Tell us what Portugal has done in all sorts of areas.
Yeah, well, Portugal and a number of countries in Europe don't criminalize drug use, where basically no one is brought into the criminal justice system simply for using or possessing a drug. And Portugal is the most well-known and most well-studied. Also, the Czech Republic, Switzerland have similar approaches, you know, but what we've seen in those countries is that after decriminalization happened, overdose deaths plummeted, HIV plummeted, addiction plummeted, and people assume that when you decriminalize drugs that, oh, well, more people are going to use drugs then, and that actually didn't happen. In fact, among youth, drug use is lower than it was than before they decriminalized. And a lot of that is because the people who want to get help are able to get help under that system. It wasn't just a criminal justice reform. At the same time they decriminalized drugs in Portugal, they also ramped up their health and harm reduction services so that treatment is available on demand to anyone who wants it. And they have very robust harm reduction programs that they don't have in the U.S., like drug checking programs, so that people can test their drugs to make sure they don't have impurities.
Apparently in Portugal, at some rock concerts and other big concerts where people, they have testing tables where people can come and they give them a small quantity and they test whether the drugs are actually good ones or they have impurities, and then they give the stuff back to the people. What they're doing is trying to root out some of the most damaging, medically damaging drugs.
The interesting thing is, even in the U.S., a lot of places are taking steps in the right direction. We've already, of course, we've seen over the past couple decades, a lot of states have passed not just medical marijuana, but marijuana legalization laws and marijuana decriminalization laws. Also, sentencing reform. California and Oregon have reduced drug possession from a felony to a misdemeanor in the past few years. I mean, there's basically a political and public and scientific consensus at this point that drug use should not be criminalized. Even the United Nations and World Health Organization released a joint statement this year calling for the repeal of laws that criminalize drug use and possession. The American Public Health Association, the International Red Cross, even groups like the NAACP and the Movement for Black Lives that are focused on civil rights and racial justice have also supported decriminalization. So we're really not that far away from it. I mean, during the presidential election last year, it was very interesting to see you had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders kind of like competing with each other for who could sound better on criminal justice reform, which you never had had before in any election, even in the Republican primary debates, besides not including Trump, but several of the other Republican candidates would say things like, oh, we can't criminalize addiction and we can't arrest our way out of the drug problem. There is a kind of like general consensus around that, both in the scientific, political, and public realm. So over the next few years, DPA is really, that's really our top priority now, is trying to mainstream and popularize the concept of decriminalization in the U.S. and to start introducing legislation and do ballot initiatives in several states. Yeah. That would do that. Last year, Maryland became the first state to introduce a bill to fully decriminalize drugs. It didn't pass, but it's going to keep getting reintroduced. So that's our goal looking forward to like 2020, for example. That's kind of the next logical step for the drug policy reform movement.
All of those changes, I think, can probably be also traced to the fact that it's now white people who are dying in huge numbers, and even in Trump states. The drug wars were really putting a lot of blacks in jail, disobedient blacks, and often framed, in fact. We all know that there's marijuana in every black car, and the police can always find it during those days, or crack or whatever. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of users as well, of course, black and white. But it seems to me partly it was really, as Michelle Alexander has pointed out, it's a part of the new Jim Crow. This is Cable Radio. Bill Resnick talking to Jack Davies of the Alliance. We've been talking about the harms of the drug wars. It's a terrible burden on all of us, and especially the people who are caught up in it, including the cops. It corrupts them. But there's also so many solutions. We discussed Portugal and a decriminalization, more treatment. Portugal also does a huge amount of outreach, actually, to people with drugs, asking them to please come in. It's not just waiting for people. It's, in fact, explaining their alternatives. Many of them don't want to stay on it. It's a tremendously effective program and not much money.
Yeah, there's an assumption I think people have that, you know, we need the coercive role of the criminal justice system to force people into drug treatment. But all the available evidence shows from the past numerous decades that coercive treatment is much less effective than voluntary treatment. When you treat people like human beings and give them the option, eventually most people do end up naturally recovering in some way, whether or not they go into a treatment program. And it's also worth noting, too, that the vast majority of people who use drugs do not use them problematically. This goes against conventional wisdom in some ways, but the data actually shows that about 80 to 90% of people who ever use crack cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, the drugs we think of as the worst of the worst, actually do not go on to develop an addiction. But because there's so much stigma around them, our focus is so much on the problematic use of them. Whether someone has a problematic relationship with drugs, though, it never makes sense to bring them into the criminal justice system. That's just going to make the situation worse no matter what.
One final thing, Jack. Much of now the drug abuse in the United States has changed from illegal sources to, in fact, the drug companies themselves, who are now have gotten the right to manufacture a whole lot more opioids like fentanyl and oxycontin and the others.
Yeah.
And they're being diverted into the, quote, illegal market, right? It's easy to get them, and they're just flooding these areas, and a lot of people are dying from them, from the stuff that comes from Colombia or Afghanistan or other places that have been...
The pharmaceutical industry in the late 90s played a role in fomenting the current opioid crisis, but I think it's also important to realize that a lot of people do have legitimate pain for which they need medications, and there's actually been a lot of laws the past few years cracking down on opioids, prescription opioids, and that has what led people to the illegal drugs. So, you know, we have to be careful. At the same time, yes, you know, the pharmaceutical industries were very irresponsible in how they promoted these medications, but at the same time, It's actually less dangerous to be using OxyContin than it is to be using heroin on the street. And what's happened over the past few years is that they've cut the prescription opioid supply a lot already, and people have switched to more dangerous drugs. So if they're going to be cutting the supply of legal opioids, what they need to also be doing then is making other forms of treatment much more available, like maintenance therapies and other forms of treatment. When you cut people off from opioids and then you don't have easy access to treatment, it's a recipe for disaster because you're pushing them into using much more risky and dangerous drugs. And now all the media attention is so much on the pharmaceutical drugs, but most people, the majority of people trying opioids for the first time now are using street heroin and fentanyl, and the vast majority of deaths are from street heroin and fentanyl. So there does need to be better regulation of the pharmaceutical industry, for sure. They are not, I don't want to defend them, but at the same time, there's, I think, more to the story.
Jed Davies, it's really good talking to you. I'm afraid we have to end, but the drug wars are not going to end, and the struggles, in fact, are heating up. People should look at what your website is great, Drug Policy Alliance. Just go there. There's a lot of things to read. Jags, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be on your show.
I'd like to make one final comment on the drug wars and how we deal with drug abuse, an issue we just didn't have time for to talk about, how to deal with drug abuse. That Portuguese success is not just due to decriminalizing and the rest of it, wonderful programs. It also, though, must be attributed to Portuguese culture and how people live, because compared to this country, it's a lot more communal, less hierarchical, less individualistic. Not a rich country, it has a relatively real safety net and universal medical care. Well, all that makes a difference, because in any country, as economic fears and social isolation grow and good work diminishes, that creates a lot of anime, emptiness, anxiety, depression. And it's not just among the poor. And then that leads to the self-medication that follows. One thing's sure, if we create a society that's more communal, that values and respects everybody, that takes action to protect all its members, that gives offenders more chances, a society that doesn't impoverish 30% of its people and really oppress many of them, and make nearly all precarious and anxious about whether and for how long they can pay the mortgage, a society in which all work has dignity, it's structured so that all are constantly learning new skills and developing, that they take meaningful roles, and particularly in the daily decisions of their workplace. In a society like that, people will live and work with much more positive experiences and feelings about themselves, and we're sure to have much less drug abuse. As old mole Clayton Morgridge pointed out in a recent commentary on this Old Mole show, it was played October 7th. It was called A Sick Individual or A Sick Society. It was about the guy who did the shooting in Las Vegas. He pointed out, I quote, "As long as we allow the world to be governed in the interest of maximizing the wealth of an already wealthy elite and subordinating all values to money values, pathological behavior of many kinds will continue."
Pure as the driven snow, connected to my mind. And now I'm having fun, baby. It's getting kinda low,
'cause it makes you feel so nice.
I need some one-on-one, baby.